Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by Ciara O'Connor Walsh, who is the director of A Lust for Life. Ciara, it's great to have you with me on Reboot Republic.
Thanks for having me, Rory.
And my son, Leo, is back again as well, Leo Hearn Strachan. Leo, how are you doing?
All good.
Good. And you're also doing work experience with Lust for Life.
Yes, I am indeed. Yeah.
So today we want to talk about Lust for Life, the mental health charity, let people know what it is, what it's doing, and discuss as well the issue which we've discussed a number of times in this podcast of mental health and young people, the challenges under COVID, and what government can and should be doing. And we're also going to look at the initiative that Lust for Life did recently called Hunt for Hope, which is a very interesting and innovative approach, I think, in terms of getting people's ideas and looking forward to the future beyond COVID and trying to put some hope within this current disastrous situation that we're in. And a reminder to our listeners, we know you're listening. Reboot Republic was the number second most listened to political podcast during the week. And there's lots of you out there. So please, please, please become a patron. Support us to keep going producing these podcasts. It's a really important space, and we're covering lots of issues at the moment, so we'd really like to keep going and we need your support. So please go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack to become a patron and supporter, please. Ciara, in terms of Lust for Life, maybe you could explain briefly what is Lust for Life and where it came from.
Yeah, so I suppose it started out with one person's journey, and that's Niall Breslin, Brezzy, mental health advocate, former athlete, podcaster, musician. And he told his story way back in 2015. He started a blog and he told his story about his mental health. And it was back when maybe people weren't quite as open about their mental health. I mean, 6 years doesn't feel like a long time ago, but it's been quite a journey in terms of how we talk about and understand mental health in this country, even over the last decade. And I suppose Brezzy's story really resonated with an awful lot of people. And what he found was he was sort of inundated with people getting in touch saying, Jesus, this really resonated with me. And I actually got a lot from reading your story, and I wouldn't mind telling my own story. And so then he started Lust for Life as a website, which was a place for people to tell their stories. And storytelling, as we know in this country, is a really powerful social change tool. We saw in, you know, Yes Equality and Repeal the Eighth, you know, the power of people telling their own stories to really chip away at that silence and stigma that surrounds a lot of crucial social issues in Ireland. And I think silence and stigma and shame have been very powerful tools at kind of sweeping things under the carpet in Ireland, and mental health and suicide is no different, you know. So it was definitely a very important tool for people to talk about their mental health journeys, and in breaking that silence, I think it was quite a profound effect. A lot of people who told their stories said, you know, how even now when people tell their stories on the website, they'll email me afterwards and say, Jesus, can't believe the response. Like, I had old schoolmates and my boss and all these people reaching out to me saying, Jesus, I never knew that you had suffered in this way. And like, God, you know, if you ever need to talk, I've gone through something similar myself. And, you know, I think those conversations should not be underestimated in terms of their power. And then I suppose A Lust for Life started doing some advocacy work around some really complicated issues like dual diagnosis. They ran a campaign called Anyone's Brother way back in 2016. They campaigned for 24/7 crisis care. They worked with Joe Caslin, the brilliant street artist, to produce an incredible mural as part of the Waterford Walls street art called We Live Protected Under Each Other's Shadow. It's this amazing, if you've ever been to Waterford in the last 5 or 6 years, you'll see it. It's an old abandoned hotel up on a hill in Waterford, and it's this beautiful image of a man standing with his arms outstretched, and there's two invisible figures holding his arms, two other men holding him up. And it's just this beautiful image of support and protection and how we need to hold on to each other. That was gorgeous. And I suppose after a couple of years, we start, I came on board back in 2018, and I am a podcast junkie and podcast nerd, and I was like, we have to do a podcast, lads. So I convinced the guys to do a series called Where There's a Will, which is kind of a deep dive investigation into the mental health system in Ireland, and it took me about 6 months to make it. It was a big piece of work, and talked to a lot of people who've been in the system, psychologists, psychiatrists, you name it, talk to kind of everybody to sort of get this 360 degree view of what the hell is wrong with the mental health system. Why is it so fecked up? Why aren't people getting the supports that they need? And the big learning that came out of that for me and, you know, for the whole team was we have to look upstream. We have to stop these people from getting into crisis. Because the mental health system is all stuffed up full of people with all these different degrees of, you know, difficulty. It could be anything from mild to moderate anxiety to severe and chronic depression, suicidality. And they're all on the same waiting list. And actually, there's a lot of those people that would never actually have to get onto a waiting list if we could get them first and maybe give them the tools and the skills that they need to be able to build resilience and understand their emotional well-being. But right back when they're kids. And, you know, I remember us sitting around a table at a meeting and going, imagine if we had been taught like how to look after your own head when you're in primary school. Imagine if we were told like what to do if someone's bullying you, or how to cope if you're worried, or what happens if you have intrusive thoughts. Imagine if you were told that that's normal. And, you know, we were nearly laughing, going like, Jesus, we got no education around our feelings whatsoever. I'm 40. And my generation got nothing, not a peep. Like, you're happy, you're sad, you're angry. The end. Those are the shades of life.
That would be quite an extensive emotional repertoire.
That's like, you know, if you're going nuts. But yeah, so, you know, we were looking at it going, Jesus, where can we have the biggest impact then? If we're to like really try and do something profound here to change the mental health system in Ireland, really, and change the landscape of mental health in Ireland for good, what can we do? And so we developed a new strategy that was focused on future generations and using content and campaigns and events to facilitate young people to be guardians of their own minds, to look after their own heads, and to also be leaders that can drive our society towards a better future, because we really believe that young people have a lot of answers and they need to be listened to a lot more than they currently are.
And how do you see that sort of linked between the mental health, you know, issues and, you know, telling stories and trying to get change around that, or support for people and change the conversation with, you know, where do you see that linking to then what you just said there about, you know, changing the wider society, a progressive society, a better future? Where do you see that link, or where does that come up?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think mental health, it's a little bit like all of the social issues in Ireland are often treated in silos, aren't they? We've got our, you know, homelessness people over here, and then we've got our addiction services, and then we've got our mental health services over here, and never the twain shall meet sometimes. And, you know, I think mental health in particular, everybody has it. It's connected to absolutely everything. And the people who are most likely to suffer are the people who are struggling from a social point of view. So if you've got problems in society across the board, the people who are at the bottom are going to be the ones that struggle mentally as well. And so in my view, a better society isn't going to stop adverse effects, adverse things happening to people. Like, people are still, shit happens, I suppose, for want of a better phrase. Things are going to happen to people that are going to be challenging and difficult to cope with. But if their life, and if, you know, if there's a level playing field, they're off to a much better start. And so, you know, we just don't see it as, you know, something Brezzi says that I often find myself quoting is equality is the best form of therapy. And we really find that kind of resonates with people when they think about it in that way. And they see that, like, yeah, actually, you level the playing field, you give everybody the best start possible in life, and of course they're going to have better mental health outcomes into the future.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, when it's such an obvious connection in many ways, but of course we don't and why I was asking there is we don't link it, and policy, you know, doesn't link it. And in terms of discussing mental health, that whole social exclusion aspect to it, the contribution that poverty makes, that inequality makes, that homelessness, that, you know, health exclusion, that, you know, low income, you know, stressful situations of you know, exclusion, marginalization, the contribution to mental health, to destructively to people's mental health, is often not linked. And in terms of just, I suppose, extending that, where is your assessment of where we are at now in terms of the pandemic? It's been described as, you know, the mental health, you know, impact of this is adding a pandemic, you know, of mental health onto a previous crisis, or as the people describe it, the pandemic within the pandemic. Where, how do you see it, or how have you seen it in your organization with young people, and what are they feeding back in terms of how the pandemic, lockdowns, you know, we're the second longest lockdown in Europe and Ireland, how is it impacting on young people's mental health?
Yeah, well, I mean, the biggest way we see it, and the most stark way we see it, is the sheer numbers of people coming to us for help. And that's just through numbers of people on our website, numbers of people engaging with our posts on social media, the emails that we're getting in from people. And I think a lot of people, a friend of mine said she was at the doctor to get a prescription renewal for antidepressants, which I think half the country is on at the moment. And the doctor told her, oh yeah, I've been prescribing this website alongside the antidepressants of Lust for Life. And I've heard that several times, that GPs, and when they can't make a referral to psychological services because they know it's going to be a couple of years before you're going to get to see somebody, possibly. Like, that's how stuffed up the services are. So they're recommending the likes of a Lust for Life, the likes of, you know, some mental health and well-being podcasts to people as a stopgap, as a, you know, as a sort of a first line of defense, because they know that they're not going to get that one-to-one support. So we're seeing that massively in terms of the numbers of people coming to us. But what we're seeing from young people in terms of the impact of lockdown, I suppose, the impact of COVID is, God, it's really grating on them at this stage. It's, you know, it's no more than the rest of us. But, you know, especially I think at the moment when a lot of the younger kids are going back to school, the older kids who are still at home watching younger siblings going out to school, we've had a couple of emails this week from parents saying, what do I do? Like, they're literally nearly crying watching their younger siblings walking out the door in the morning because they know that they're going to have to spend the whole day at home again. And I think the isolation, and Leo, you can probably speak to this, but like, the isolation is so much more intense at that age. Like, they miss their friends. They badly miss their friends. We think we miss our friends. Like, there's a lot of research actually out there about young people that suggests that when something bad happens, young people cope way better emotionally when they're with their peers than when they're with adults. And it's this time when it's so natural to start distancing from parents and immediate family and start building that, you know, real tight peer group. And imagine being stuck at home. Like, I actually was thinking about this when I was on my walk earlier, and you was going to be talking to you about it. And I was like thinking about, imagine if I was in this pandemic and I was 15. Like, I would rather be socially distanced from my family at 15 than my mates. Like, I'd be like, just stick me in a shed with a load of my mates. It'd be grand. But, you know, I think so many young people are missing the outlets that they have as well. Like, you know, a lot of them find a lot of solace in sports and drama and dance and music, and or just hanging out with mates, and all of those outlets are gone. And, you know, I think at the beginning we really recognized that in a different way, as, you know, collectively we were going, God, imagine the young people and they can't do their GAA and they're missing all these milestones, like their Debs isn't happening, that must be really hard. But a year in, it kind of feels like, in the conversation that I'm hearing, it's almost just expected. No, you just don't get to do that anymore, and that's just it. And I think, you know, also what we're hearing from a lot of parents is they're kind of forgetting what it's like to have those things, which is kind of scary. And a lot of parents have been saying that their teenage children in particular are becoming very withdrawn and introverted and quiet. That's kind of scary as well. But you mentioned the socioeconomic thing as well. And there was a report in the British Medical Journal this week basically saying that families who are facing financial adversity, families that are more socioeconomically deprived, are consistently reporting across the board, children and young people, consistently worse mental health outcomes. And, you know, there is going to be an economic recession, and that is going to impact them much more gravely. And so I think it's only going to get worse. So that is incredibly worrying.
Go on, sorry.
Oh no, just one more thing to say in terms of what we're hearing is one thing that I'm hearing a lot from young people is that a lot of conversations are happening around them and about them, but without them. We're not really hearing from them, and I think that's a big problem. They're very, very tired of having, you know, being excluded from the conversation, especially around the Leave and Cert. And every time I saw a panel of men in suits talking about what's good for young people and what they should be doing about the Leave and Cert, I would bristle, because I just think what I want to hear on drive time is a 15-minute interview with a Leave and Cert student. I don't want to hear some official from the Department of Education just parroting back, you know, what they've been media trained to say about it. You know, I want to actually hear from young people what's good for them. I think there's a real reluctance to give young people the microphone.
Well, we don't do that here.
Clearly,
we're handing the microphone over, Leo. In terms of,
sorry.
Oh yeah, what? Go on, yeah.
I think that just cut off there. My phone, sorry.
No, just the. What's your experience in terms of, you know, where we're at now? Like, how do you? You as a young person, your friends or people you're talking to are seeing on social media, how are young people doing at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's just like, it's very socially isolating. A lot of what Kira said, like, I completely agree with. I think it's very hard for the people that like have so much that like we would be doing in this time that we're completely missing out on, you know? Like, I'm in fourth year right now. I would have been going on trips and getting closer with classmates and stuff like that. But instead, I've gotten more distance from classmates because I'm not seeing them in person or anything like that. And I think it's just a very big thing of, yeah, like, feeling kind of looked over at a point, like, and not included in the conversation. I think a lot of them are having a very hard time. And even just isolated from, like, your friends in general, because some people aren't good at texting, like stuff as simple as that, which you just can't really help. Yeah, I think it's definitely just very hard on everyone.
And in terms of that isolation, because I think it's not something, you know, as you do you see it part of the national conversation about what we're talking about, the impact of COVID, and do you see it? Do you see yourself and your concerns included in there?
No, I think there's definitely some level of being looked over. They're like, ah, the teenagers are fine. They'll be fine. But like, it is the most social years of your life and all that. And you're just kind of missing out on them. Yeah, it's just pretty intense. You're missing out and it's not really being talked about. Because a lot of the time it's not something that can be fixed. Like, because obviously I can't go out with friends every day of the week or else COVID's going to go up, you know? But I definitely think it's something that should be mentioned and considered. Like, the young children going to school, even though, like, people in older years are a lot better at distancing and stuff like that, you know?
Like, so it's not even talked about, and you know, I think it is, and you know, I see it in terms of you as well, you know, and we've talked about this, that it, you know, you're, as you say, you're around us all the time. You don't want to be around your parents all the time. We're like looking at each other, and you know,
like Kira said, you'd much rather be distanced with friends than distanced with your family at the moment, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And that is hard. And these years are so important and so formative. You know, I think it's something that, and those voices and your voices need to be heard, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
And in terms of then, I suppose, going on. Just before actually we do go on to Hunt for Hope, because I think that's a something that's really, I suppose, practical in this time to try and, you know, give young people that space and voice. Kira, just in terms of, because, you know, it's something I always try to get on Reboot, is, you know, the solutions, the policy, like what should be done around mental health supports right now, do you think?
Well, I mean, everyone says this, but I genuinely believe there just needs a massive focus on prevention. I think there's something a bit nebulous about mental health prevention, because it's very hard to see the outcomes of something that doesn't happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's very easy to treat things when they do happen, and then you go, oh, all these people are now in treatment and they're getting better. Whereas investing in something so it doesn't happen, it's not very easy to measure, and it's not very politically expedient as a result. But I actually do think there has been a lot of talk around mental health with policymakers at the moment. And I think that we need to try and capitalize on that as advocates for mental health. And we need to really put pressure on them to say, guys, you need to start giving everybody, this isn't for the many or for the few, it's for the many. All of us need tools and supports to be able to deal with our mental health, and we need to be able to be given them at an earlier age. So I think we badly need to innovate when it comes to youth mental health. I think we need to meet young people where they're at. We need to speak their language. We need to look at things like peer support models, models of engagement through gaming, through activities like drama and sport, and involving young people in their communities. I think there's so many different things that are mental health adjacent that we could use as really crucial interventions for prevention. Like, I live in Thomastown in Kilkenny, and there's gangs of teenagers that just hang out beside the playground. There's just a table and chairs, just like a picnic table. And there's like 20 teenagers that just stand around there pretty much all day, every day when the schools were closed, and all weekend. There's nowhere for them to go. There's nothing for them to do. But, you know, if the restrictions were even a tiny bit looser, like say level 4 over the summer, there's so much that could be done. Like, there's no reason, there's GAA pitches in every town, even tiny villages in Ireland, that they couldn't be turned into socially distant spaces for all kinds of other activities. You know, outdoor arts, music, other sports. Like, we have the space. We know outdoors is safe. We need to provide ways for young people to connect. I think those connections are going to be the thing that makes a difference. Those connections will be a lifeline for young people. And there's all these different potential avenues, I think, for innovations. And I think the last time I was on, I talked about forest schools and you were laughing at me. But, like, you know, there's not going to be the Gaeltachts and there's not going to be the summer camps this summer. So what are we going to do? I think it's up to us to think of solutions for young people. And Leo, you might have a better idea of what might work there. But, oh, Leo's gone.
He's gone.
It's almost like I magicked him away by asking him a question.
You did. He disappeared there. We'll see if we can get him back. But I think, yeah, no, I did laugh at the forest schools because that was a funny idea. Seriously, it was a good idea. And I said that at the time, it was a good idea. We need lots of this lateral thinking. And it is so true. And I think as well, even in terms of youth work and the youth work sector and how that has been cut back, you know, over the years since austerity and hasn't been replaced, but there's such a need for, you know, that engagement and spaces and you know, youth workers, even in that field, that no, we're not, you know, we're not thinking about that how do we, as you say, engage in that preventative, you know, measures that actually engage people now. Leo, we were saying Kira magicked you away there.
Yeah. Sorry, I think
she was saying, have you any ideas? No. Okay, delete, gone. That's how we treat the young people.
Silenced on your own podcast.
My internet just completely cut off there. Sorry.
No, we were just talking about the, you know, potential ideas for young people in the summer and that. Is there anything you think that, you know, could be done to support young people in this time and particularly thinking towards the summer as well?
I think like just an increase of where you can go. Like, it would be nice to be able to like go to the beach with your friends or like some level. I think, okay, so remember a bit back, they were like, okay, you can bubble with like one other household if you have a single parent or something. But I think an emphasis on like small groups of friend bubbles. Like, if I had even like two or three people that I would stick with, you know, I think that could help a lot of people a lot, you know. I think something like that. Like, now hopefully over the summer restrictions ease a bit more, so it'll be a couple more than two or three people. But yeah, just some emphasis and thought on like giving teenagers some way to hang out with each other. And I think like encouraging not mixing with everyone, but mixing with like a couple people that you know are safe nearly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. No, it does. It does.
The blanket ban, like, you're only going to, like, if I was 15 and this was going on, I would, and it was a blanket ban on seeing anyone, I would be at a party. I would. I was that sort of a teenager. I was a brat. And I would have been there front and center going, woohoo, I'm going to like completely rebel against this. Whereas, like you say, Leo, you respect people, you give them the autonomy to be able to make decisions. You say, hey, you can connect with a few different people. And then there's less kind of impetus to go, oh, feck this all together and just go to a big session.
Yeah, I really think so. I think that would genuinely do more for like curbing it than a complete ban. Like, you see a lot of people out, and I think that would genuinely be helped if you did something like that.
I think as well, the whole engagement with young people in youth services and in other ways and spaces and activities that can engage them is something that's really important, because we're seeing as well, you know, the reports during the week there in places like Ballymun, you know, areas of disadvantage where young people have been groomed into gangs, been involved into drugs, you know, the violence. And you see that, you know, in these times when young people are just been, you know, in many ways abandoned, that this is what's happening, that the you know, those inequalities grow further and deeper.
Yeah, because there's a vacuum there, of course, it's going to be filled. So I think ignoring it and pretending it's not happening, or just kind of going, oh, well, I'm afraid it's a pandemic, there's nothing we can do. There's so much we can do.
Yeah,
there's so much we can do that's safe, and we absolutely should be. There should be some sort of a national movement, and I think massive funding for the youth work sector would be a really good idea about now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that really needs to be prioritized. And you know, the European Central Bank is printing money for free at the moment, so whatever money we need, you know, we can put it into it. But I just was making the point that, you know, in the past, not even in the past, but, you know, during the years of austerity where they cut back on things, and, you know, youth services was one area that was cut back that I said, but we should be just putting the resources and supports in there. But another focus, and, you know, I know Lust for Life will continue to campaign and highlight on this. So we'll move on to Hunt for Hope. Kira, Leo, do you want to explain what is Hunt for Hope?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I think myself and Leo and the team sat around the table back in, was it January, Leo? I think it was. Yeah, and we just said, look, we're about to face into our third major lockdown. COVID numbers were spiraling, and we knew that children and young people all over Ireland were really struggling. Everyone was feeling totally worn out, totally fatigued, bored, pissed off, despairing. And, you know, we wanted to do something that was meaningful and that wasn't kind of like bridge magnet philosophy, sort of let's all be hopeful, yay. So we thought really carefully about it. And, you know, hopefulness about the future is sort of the opposite of despair. And we thought, that's when we don't have a plan, which is what everybody's talking about now. If you ever open Twitter, it's like, we need a plan. I think we're all like, we don't have an end in sight. We don't have a clear roadmap for how this is all going to end. So how do you get up in the morning, get dressed, put on a face and go about your business when you don't know where this is all going to go? And so there's a thing in psychology they call the hopeful imagination. And a lot of the times in psychology, if you're in therapy, your psychologist will get you to hope about what's going to happen in the future or make plans for the future, to counteract those feelings of despair or, you know, not being able to see past the end of your nose when you're in a black hole. And, you know, with this campaign, I suppose we were inviting everybody to collectively to go through this therapeutic process of, okay, let's look past this moment and see what's at the end of it. What are we going to do? And we wanted people to share where they're getting their hope from. And it could be as stupid as I'm going to think Paula's one was, she was going to go down and throw the pair of tracksuit bottoms she's been living in for a year and a half into the bin. And, you know, that she can't wait for that moment. Yeah. And some of them were more profound. You know, I want to hold my grandmother's hand. She's in a nursing home. You know, I want to see my friends and give them a hug. I want to feel a hug from someone. A lot of people who are living on their own, who just haven't actually had a physical human being touch them in 6 months or even longer. That was what we wanted to tap into. We wanted to share and kind of create a bit of a wave of that.
Yeah. And so, Leo, what was your kind of thinking around it when you were developing it?
I think a lot of it was like trying to share some of the hope, like, because for some people, as Kira said, they can't see at any point. So like, if we got a load of people to put together their hopes and like share them, maybe we could give some other people those hopes. So if like you can't find your own hope, you can look there and be like, oh wow, that is something I'm looking forward to, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's instilling the sense of community, like showing that we're all in this together. We all like want these things. We have these hopes. And like in putting in the hopes, we're saying this will be our future. This can be a reality soon, you know, like keep on looking forward.
Mm. And that's an interesting idea, that community idea. What were you kind of thinking about that? Or, you know, we're all in this together. How would the Hunt for Hope work on that?
Well, yeah, I think, as I said, it's just like showing that like we do all have these hopes, and like if we band together, then this is what we can do. Because like we were trying to give people hopes through the lockdown, because it was just starting again. Everyone was feeling very weary. So it's like the sense of togetherness, because you're seeing all these other people's hopes.
Excuse me. Sorry. Yeah. Maybe you could, you know, we were chatting earlier about, would you like to, or I'd asked you to, read some of them out as examples?
Yeah, of course. I can.
It'd be great to hear some of them.
Yeah, so let's see. Okay, I've got them here. I submitted a hope myself. So I said, my hope for once this is all over is just to be able to explore nature with my friends again. I miss going to beaches and forests and the countryside and unknown places, and seeing it all with the people I care about. I hope that soon enough I'll get that opportunity to see the world again. And then another hope was, my hunt for hope is that my brother will be able to fly home from Melbourne this year and spend Christmas at home in Dublin. And then someone listed some of their hopes. They said, my nieces giggle, my nephews rolling their eyes as I sing to them, noisy family dinners where we're hitting off each other's elbows because there's not enough room at the table, hugs on the beach. And then another one was, my hunt for hope is being able to see my family and friends and be able to celebrate together some major occasions we have missed over the last year, be able to do the things we've taken for granted and to explore the world and learn new things. Someone else said, looking forward to group walks, trips to the cinema, lunch and dinner with different groups of friends whenever the majority of us have received our vaccinations. Then someone else said, I'm holding on to hope that the time will come soon enough to be able to go to outdoor concerts. I've still got all my tickets from last year and they've all been rescheduled. Hoping too for picnics, treks and holidays, any outdoor hangouts with friends at all, basically. And then someone said, I would like to be in Dublin in the Abbey to see a play, squashed in my seat, shoulder to shoulder with friendly strangers queuing for my interval drink, moving through the doors in the midst of the buzzing crowd at the end of the evening. Oh, to dream. And then someone said, my hope is returning to being a rugby supporter and going to games again at Leinster, Connacht, Ulster and Munster. I miss it more than words will ever describe. And then someone said, I'm looking forward to a weekend in Strandhill, County Sligo. Burgers, ice cream, beach walks. That was just a couple of them. We have lots up on the website.
Very good. Very good. I think that captures very well a sense of what people are looking forward to. Kira, did you have one?
Yes, I did. Two of my best friends are drag performers in the George, and I just want to go to their show, which is called Win, Lose, or Drag. And it's like an 80s TV game show, but hosted by drag queens. And it's very silly. And I usually go along, and when I go along, they sit me up the front and make fun of me, and I get horribly drunk, and it's brilliant. I'm surrounded by fabulous people wearing sequins and fake eyelashes and glitter, and it's just all very fabulous. And I really miss that, and I really, really miss my friends at Dublin, because nearly all my friends live in Dublin. I moved to Kilkenny when my little boy was born 3.5 years ago, and I just miss my friends in Dublin so much. I just want to squish their faces and see them all soon, and yeah, be silly in the George. That's my hope, and I'm holding on to it. I also have tickets for the Deftones in June, which is definitely not going to happen, but I still look at them every so often and go, that could happen. If we get back, how many people would need to be vaccinated for the RDS to be open? And I do all this mental gymnastics trying to figure it out. I know in my heart of hearts it's not happening, but I'm just going to hold on to it as a little beacon for now.
They're wonderful, wonderful hopes. I want to see my hope is that my children get to see their grandparents this summer. They haven't seen them since last summer. And obviously Leo being one of them there. But the little ones in particular, you know, they change so much in the space of months, not to mind a year. And to not see their grandparents is just, it's horrendous. And you know, you think of, anyway, I'm just going to start getting really angry at all the flights and stuff going on and people traveling around, and when we don't go to see our grandparents. But that's one hope. And the other hope is, and Leo might laugh at this one, is I went to, now this isn't, I don't know when it's actually going to happen, but when it does, I'm not going to miss it, which is the next time Bruce Springsteen comes to Ireland. I saw him.
What age are you, Rory?
I'm 41. And I went to see him with my brother in Cork in 2013 or 14. And it was an amazing concert. And we drove down from Waterford to Cork, and we stopped in this beautiful little place. It was in the summer, near on the Copper Coast near Annstown. And we went in for a swim, and it was the most gorgeous swim. Fabulous. And then went down to the gig, and it was just amazing, amazing time. Me and my brother on the road trip, and seeing Bruce Springsteen, and it was amazing. And
the bus.
Yeah, and I've been playing that song on the radio for Leo has probably heard it like incessantly for the last few days as a reminder of what life will be again, and my hope. So, that's my one.
Mine sound a bit frivolous now compared to yours, because my little boy hasn't seen his grandparents either, but my hope is still the George.
Yeah, sounds wonderful as well.
Priorities.
Yeah, exactly. And in terms of impact, Kira, what sort of impact did it have, the Hunt for Hope, do you think?
Yeah, well, we got hundreds of entries in across email and through social media, and reached over 1.2 million people through all of our social and digital channels. And we had a live launch event where our chairperson, Paula, interviewed the lovely Luke O'Neill and Ian Robertson about hope and the psychology and science of hope. And that, I think it was over 2,500 people attended that on the night. That went really, really well. And then we launched the Gallery of Hope with Sir Steve O'Timothy, the comedian, and Andrea, our lovely Andrea, interviewed him, did a live session as well, and a few thousand people at that. So we've really seen a lot of people. It sparked something for people. And I'm really glad that we got a load of positive comments and messages from people saying, God, I feckin' needed to read this. We wanted it to be really authentic and not like, oh, I hope this will all be over and we'll all be, you know, we wanted to hear like real proper, like I want a pint and a feckin' toasty outside Grogan's kind of hopes, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we got, which I think.
Yeah, just, no, you clearly, kinda clearly
heartwarming.
Did. Yeah. No, clearly achieved it. Well done. It's. What do you feel, Leo, in terms of what it achieved?
Yeah, I think, again, it like showed people that there is hope, and definitely reached out to a lot of people, which I think is the most important people and what is the most important thing that we were looking to reach as many people as possible. I think definitely achieved that. It got a lot of interaction.
Great, great. Well, listen, Kira and Leo, it was lovely to have you on Reboot again. Kira, do you want to, or maybe Leo, will you let people know where can they see The Hunt for Hope? Where can they find out about Lust for Life and what it's doing?
So there's the Lust for Life website. It's just, if you look up A Lust for Life, it'll come up on Google. And then The Hunt for Hope is one of the articles. You can find it very easily. There's an art piece at the start and all the different hopes that you want to look through. And that's where you find Hunt for Hope.
Great. Great. Thanks.
And can I plug something quickly?
Absolutely. Do. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So I just, when I was giving out about young people's voices not being heard, I'm working with a brilliant group of young people. They're Leaving Cert students who are producing a podcast called The Student Perspective. And it's just about their views and opinions on current affairs, politics, Leaving Cert reform, mental health, well-being, everything that happens in life. And they're absolutely fabulous bunch of four amazing young people. And if you want to hear their views on the world around us right now, tune into The Student Perspective. It's deadly.
Great, great. Sounds wonderful. Kira O'Connor Walsh, Director of Lust for Life, thanks for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
Thanks a million for having me, Rory.
And Leo Hearn-Strachan, my son. Wonderful to have you on again.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Great, great. And a reminder to our listeners, you can check out Lust for Life, lustforlife.com, and see what is going on in terms of support and all the issues they're working on. And a reminder as well, please, if you can, become a supporter of Reboot Republic. Support us to keep producing these podcasts. And you can become a supporter by going over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and sign up for whatever you can each month to help us contribute to the cost of producing these podcasts. Show us you love us and you support what we're doing. Thank you very much. And we'll talk to you soon.